Listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice, I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program is the U.S. economy with Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman. The great Joseph Stiglitz is the author of The Price of Inequality, and the equally great Paul Krugman is the author of End This Depression Now, and they talk about the problems facing the U.S. economy.
I'm very excited, and I think we're all very excited, to see probably two people who are, I would say, unquestionably, the most cited economists in the world today. And they, in addition to being most cited, and as you all know, both are Nobel laureates, I would have to say from the vantage point of the Institute for New Economic Thinking that if I were to nominate two people as being the most courageous economists in the world and the most impactful, these would be my two finalists. So I'm very excited to be part of this conversation with both of you. As you know, each of them has written a book that pertains to our current challenges and circumstance. Joe Stiglitz's book, The Price of Inequality, and Paul Krugman's book, End This Depression Now, are part of your goodie bag tonight. And therefore, on behalf of them, I'll thank you for your patronage. But I think we should move right to the discussion. Let's start with Paul. Paul, you talked about the title of your book, End This Depression Now. There are a lot of people who don't believe we could end this depression now. What agency do human beings have to take on this challenge?
Yeah. So I spend a fair bit of time looking back at the Great Depression, because I think what we're seeing is something that is recognizably the same kind of animal as the Great Depression. Obviously not as bad as the Great Depression. That's our optimistic slogan, not as bad as the Great Depression, really pretty bad, and recognizably the same kind of thing. The technology is still there, the human skills are still there, the resources are there, but we're not actually making use of them. And so we're in that same kind of slump. And if you go back to the 1930s, you find a lot of people making the argument that there were no easy answers, no quick fix, that it was absurd to think that you could quickly get out of this. Absurd to think that, particularly that these Keynesian types who said that all we need is an increase in government spending to boot us out, that's crazy. And there are wonderful. There are articles in 1939 published in the American Economic Review explaining that these are fundamental problems, and what we really need to do to if we want to make progress is structural reform and cut unemployment benefits and things like that. And then along came, not actually the war, but just the war came in Europe, and the United States began preparing. We began our military buildup really in 1939, and within 2 years, total employment had increased by 20%, the equivalent of adding 27 million jobs right now, just like that. And it turned out that the only problem was there was not enough spending in the economy, and there was one player in the economy who could and should have been spending more, which was the government. And thanks to Adolf Hitler, all of a sudden that player finally finally did what it should have been doing all along and began increasing spending. It's the same thing right now. There's overwhelming confirmation now that this is a time when having the government spend more would be really free. It would be putting people to work who would otherwise be unemployed. It would be putting capital to work that would be basically doing nothing. And it's actually very easy technically. It's very hard politically because it's very hard to persuade people of the need to do that, which is why some of us write books.
Now, some of those who would argue with you would say, you do the spending, it's right. Like a sugar pill. It gives you a boost for a transient period of time, and then you fall back. But we didn't fall back into the Depression after World War II. What happened?
I think it's a very interesting story, right? If you want to ask the question, why did World War II, why wasn't it a temporary, but why didn't we slide back into the Depression, which lots of people thought we would. Mm-hmm. In fact, there were the famous story. Montgomery Ward was a major store chain, but the president of Montgomery Ward believed that the Great Depression was going to come back, and so he hoarded cash instead of building stores and kept on waiting for the Depression to come back, and by the time it became clear it wasn't going to, they had basically lost their position in the marketplace. So it was not a question that's been studied as much as it should have been. But the best going story right now about what is really going on, which is also the best going story about what was really going on in the 1930s, was about excessive private sector debt. But you'd had a debt bubble that, when it burst, left people stranded with too much debt. And what happened during World War II was that we had, first of all, a period of very full employment, which made it easy for people to pay down debt. They also couldn't borrow, so they were more or less forced to pay down debt, plus a significant amount of inflation, so that the real value of the debt fell. And so you came into World War II with quite high levels of private debt, of household debt relative to income. And by the time the war was over, those levels were well under half what they had been before the war, and so you'd solve the problem. And so the best thing you can do, if your problem is excessive indebtedness, what you want is a strong economy, and maybe a little bit of inflation, but certainly a strong economy, so that people have a chance to pay that debt down, and then it does not come back. It's not a sugar high. It actually is, it's more like a diet of essential nutrients that enables you to actually recover from your ailment.
There are a couple of other factors that I'd add. There was, in some sense, forced savings during the war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that meant when we got, after the war, people just had very strong balance sheets, which they could spend. At the same time, part of the problem at the time of the Great Depression was that we had to move people from agriculture into industry. The problem is, we had been a success because we had increased agricultural productivity enormously in the 19th century. In the 19th century, we still had 60-70% of the people working and farming. By 1930, it was down to about 25-30%. Today, we have 2%. But we had to move them into manufacturing from rural to urban. They didn't have the resources to do it. But in the war, they had to move because that's where the plants were. We began to equip people for this new middle-of-the-century industrial economy. And then we did something important. We had the GI Bill. So we gave them the education that made them suited for this new economy. So we were actually, it was not just the government was spending. Government, unintentionally in a sense, was restructuring the economy, making it prepared for the post-war period. Alex Fields also has a really interesting book in the history of this period. And he also pointed out that in the period of the 30s, the government was actually doing a lot of investment in roads, and that increased productivity. And that after the war, that productivity actually increased the returns to investment in the private sector. Mm-hmm. And so it created the context, plus a lot of R&D that was done during the war. So we had a backlog. Public spending had provided a context in which private investment had a higher return.
Yeah, this is actually an important point. It's, in general, we've got this notion that the public sector and the private sector are always in competition, but quite a lot, especially public investment, is complementary to private investment. I mean, there's a lot of things that people will do if they believe that there's an adequate transportation network, if they believe that the power network is adequate, if they believe that they're going to have skilled workers available because they've had good education. And sure. I think I tend to be, strip it down to the minimal story, and my minimal story would be just about the debt, but the other stuff is there as well. well. And of course, all of this reinforces just how crazy what we're doing right now is. I mean, we have states and mostly state and local governments canceling infrastructure projects because revenue is depressed, because the economy is depressed, which is exactly the opposite of how we got out of the Great Depression, right?
And in fact, I mean, one way we haven't focused on, Europe talks about austerity. We don't talk about it, but we're practicing.
Yeah, we do it. If you actually look at the measures,
we have about 600,000, 700,000 fewer public employees than we did before the crisis. When if we had a normal expansion corresponding to the increase in the labor force, we would have gained about 1.2 million employees. So there's a big gap there caused by this kind of austerity that we already have. To me, the real danger is if the Romney gets elected, they might actually do what they say they might do.
Right.
And
that is a remarkable feature of the current political environment, that your best hope is that one of the candidates is, in fact, lying through his teeth about his plans.
We sit now in what feels like prolonged stagnation. Joe, you've written a book on inequality. This cannot be a positive development for the distribution of proceeds to have idle labor, what they call the reserve army of the unemployed, driving wages down, weakening the bargaining power.
Inequality has become a serious problem, I think, in the United States. I mean, what's interesting, while Paul has been arguing about this and I've been arguing about it for a long time, it's gotten so serious that even The Economist realizes that it's a serious problem. When they say it's a serious problem, you got to believe it.
You mean the magazine, The Economist?
The magazine,
from
the
UK.
Not our colleagues, no. But the magazine, The Economist.
Our colleagues will never wake up. No, I'm sorry.
No, it's my job to take them on. You guys take on the magazine.
So, and one of the reasons that it weakens the economy, what Paul has emphasized, the problem right now is lack of demand, lack of total demand, and that means people are not buying as many goods as the economy has the capacity to produce, and that leads to unemployment. Well, one of the problems is if you transfer money from the bottom of the economic pyramid to the top, the people at the top save about 15% of their income. The people at the bottom spend everything. I mean, they need to spend everything to get by. And so when you engage in that kind of transfer, it lowers total aggregate demand. There is now a vicious cycle going on that because of the high unemployment, wages are being dripped down. The share of wages is weaker than it otherwise would be. And so that, in turn, weakens demand. And even before the crisis, incomes in the middle were not doing very well. Median income today is lower than it was a decade and a half ago. So there is a vicious cycle, a circle in place, where a weak economy leads to more inequality, leads to a weaker economy.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Yeah, we could go out there. There are some technical... I don't want to go too deep into the weeds here. I'm not totally persuaded of that channel, as it turns out, because, in fact, the overall savings rate, even now, is still well below what it was in 30 years ago. We used to have like 8% private savings, and now it was zero for a while there. It's around four now, and that's so. There's something that the debt issues, I think, are very real. The inequality leads many people to go into debt to attempt to maintain a middle class standard of living. Actually, above all, an attempt to have a house in a middle class neighborhood so that their kids could have a decent school. But I'm not sure that I think that there's a story that runs through debt rather than just a simple mechanical.
Yeah, but I mean, but that the point. I guess we should be aware. A lot of the discussion talks about the American consumers coming back. And before the crisis, the savings rate in the United States was zero.
Yeah.
And we hope it won't come back
that way.
That was obviously not sustainable. And as one of my predecessors as chairman of the council once said, that which is not sustainable is not going to be sustained.
That's what the canonical version, this is Stein's law, was if something cannot go on forever, it will stop.
But the point is that if you roughly divide the population, the upper 20% historically saved about 15% of their income.
Yeah.
but they have now about 40% of all the income. And if you just do that arithmetic, that means that we should be expecting a 6% savings rate rather than the 4.5% that we have now. So in some sense, savings are depressed relative to what we might have expected. So it is even conceivable, as people get adjusted new standards of living, that we will see the savings rates increase from the current 4.5% level. And that is another reason why we should be worried over this long recession, that the restorative forces in place on their own are very weak.
With regard to inequality in your study, we talked a little bit about the prolonged slump as a contributing factor. What other dimensions do you see as causes of inequality?
Well, there are lots of causes of inequality, and there are lots of dimensions to inequality. There's the fraction of the income that's going to the top, the hollowing out at the middle, and the increase in the number of people in poverty at the bottom. And each of them has their own causes and multiple causes. At the top, which has gotten a lot of attention, the 99% and 1%. One of the factors that is to say even the economist has now recognized, and that I talk about in my book, is that a lot of the income at the top comes from what economists call rent seeking. That is to say, things like monopoly power, activities where people are trying to grab a larger share of the pie rather than trying to make the economic pie bigger. Other examples besides, a monopolist gets his profits by reducing production rather than, and restricting production. Other examples were the exploitative activities of the financial sector, where they were moving money from the bottom of the pyramid to the top through abusive credit card practices, predatory lending, a whole set of things that have now been exposed. That wasn't making the economy more efficient. Arguably, it was actually making even more unstable. Paul Volcker said there wasn't a single financial innovation that had led to the increase in productivity of the American economy, except the ATM machine. And what he was wrong was the ATM machine is a British innovation, not an American innovation.
And since he said that, they raised my fees from $1 to $3.
Right. So that's another example. The CEOs have taken advantage of deficiencies in corporate governance to increase the share of the corporate income that they get. No evidence that they've become that much more productive or that they're that much more productive than CEOs in other parts of the world. But what they have become is better at getting a larger share of the pie. You have to admit there's a certain amount of cleverness in that. But it hasn't led our economy to be more efficient. In fact, money that could have gone into investment or
R&D,
is spent on their salaries.
Yeah, I like to do a division. Take the U.S. economy since the early post-war years. And it roughly divides about in half at this point into two eras. The first era was the sort of legacy of the New Deal, which was an era of where corporations viewed themselves as being more of a kind of coalition of stakeholders rather than just ruthless capitalism, fairly strong labor unions, of course, quite high tax rates at the top. And then the second era, which is this era of financial capitalism, deregulation, capitalism red in tooth and claw, and there's a widespread belief. Talk to people, talk to an anchor on CNBC, and they just know that transition from the old stodgy thing to the new, that led to an explosion of economic growth and higher efficiency, and it must have made everybody better off. And it's absolutely not true. Growth was slower in the second half, and of course, the big difference is that the benefits of growth stopped being spread to the general population. They all went to a relative handful of people at the top. My complaint about Occupy was that they're actually setting the cut too low. It's not even really the 1%, it's the 0.1% that the people have really made big.
And in the earlier period, Paul is absolutely right about it. In the earlier period, every quintile, every fifth of the every group in the population was growing, but the bottom part was growing faster than the top. Today, it's not that way. And GDP doesn't really give you a good measure of what's happening to our economy, to our society. So while that 0.1% has been doing very well, 1% doing very well, median income is lower than it was a decade and a half ago. Median wealth is as low as it was two decades ago. So all the increase of wealth has gone to the top. So it's clear that in these ways, our economy hasn't been functioning as well as it did in that period in which we were growing together.
Paul, You're one of the leading thinkers about what they call new trade theory. And international issues relate to inequality. We've seen a tremendous amount of fights in Ohio just in the last month or so between Romney and Obama over the role of China in all of this. How do you see international factors at all?
There's several different pieces there. One of them, just coming back to why is our economy depressed? We used to have much higher private savings rates than we do now. How were we able to have full employment given that? We did not have consistent large budget deficits. What was filling the hole? What makes it so much harder? And if you just sort of do the adding up, it is the persistent trade deficit. We used to not have one, and now we do, and that's a big drag on the economy. Which has gotten better, actually. Trade deficit is actually significantly down. And some of it is just because our economy is depressed, but not all. We've actually had some. The U.S. has actually become more competitive. But that's a front on which we need to work. And there is the trouble is the political debate has not kept up with the reality here. It's all about China. Actually, China is no longer the core of that anymore. It's a much broader set of countries. Something to be worked on. So I hope that the next president, instead of not just crude China bashing, but we'll try to say what do we need to do to have a world that is no longer basically a world in which we don't have everybody trying to run a trade surplus, which the Germans believe is possible, but the rest of us have this problem with the world.
Left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right,
I'm not the only one to see through your skin thin veil of lies, though sometimes I have to look around. Maybe if I bought a gun and drove around in my Hummer, yum, oh my, I'd blend right in and not be found. Conform now that you're the norm. I'm not sure this quite holds true. Why am I distressed? Can't you sense the mess? We're not red or white, just blue. Coming out from you, it may not be the whole view. I bet your advisors would deny, 'cause that's what they are made to do, to follow like a maid and cry whenever dirt gets in your eye. You're the norm. I'm not sure this quite holds true. Why am I distressed? Can't you sense this mess? We're not red or white, just blue. Sure this. this quite holds true. Why am I distressed? Can't you sense this mess? We're not red or white, just blue.
Now for something completely different.